They prod their charges back into the van and slam the doors shut. The van starts up. The garage door slowly rises, and off they ride into the cold night, exhaust plumes blowing in the wind. The others get back in their SUVs. Todd jogs back to his after killing the lights. They ride out into the night, back to the ruin, while the garage door descends. Time, 2:45 a.m. The van with Pete's assassins drives west on a dark, snow-swept I-80. It pulls into the deserted rest area and stops parallel to the curb. Captives are released, their nylon binds cut, and told to line up in front of the entrance to the small building with the restrooms. "Smile for the camera, guys," says Sean to the four guys in briefs and running shoes. In the minus 40 wind chill, they grasped their chests with crisscrossed arms with legs tightly clasped together. Several cell phone camera pictures are taken before the van speeds off. All four dash into the small building, which, smelling of urine, is wonderfully warmer than outside. They look at one another and at the dark, lamp-lit parking area beyond, dumbfounded. They are cold and abandoned on the prairie, standing in a small brick lavatory. The fluorescent light fixtures buzz in the fan, and a scuffed old green built-in electric wall heater rumbles against the cold. One of them says as he points out at the lot, "That Shea guy was right. We really do have a problem." Outside, an 18-wheeler rolls slowly to a stop. It sits and waits. Finally, two bearded truckers alight and, pointing at the guys visible through the building's large glassed front, jog towards the building. As they near and pass under one of the sodium vapor lamps, they see one has a gun. They panic and rush through the steel men's room door and barricade themselves behind it. The truckers now inside the building try pushing on the door, but without result. The prospect of 3 days on the road to Barstow with these three drivers made the four very serious about keeping the door closed. A few shots are fired at the door, but they fail to penetrate the thick metal panel. After several minutes of unaccepted solicitations, the drivers pee on the floor and stomp back to their big sleeper and drive off. Cautiously, the four creep back into the small lobby when they hear the truck roar off in the distance. They look with relief as they see the taillights recede. That relief is short, as from the left, about 2 miles distance, they spot highway patrol cars, lights flashing, heading their way fast. One of the four quickly says to the others, "Okay, here's our story. We were kidnapped by those two truckers and escaped here, right? Got it?" "Where were we kidnapped?" asks one. "I don't know, back in Omaha, a block southwest of that club where we waited in Joe's van. Say we were going to the club when we were held up at gunpoint. My car's near there anyway. Don't say anything about what happened at the club. We know nothing. Tell them it happened about 9:30. They'll never buy it. You got a better story? After that mess at the club, they won't give a damn about us. You heard the shooting and the screaming back there. The police will only be interested in that case right now. Just say we were kidnapped at gunpoint. Anyway, the bullet holes in the door should prove we were telling the truth. Tell them we got away when they stopped to take a piss. We ran out the door and beat them in here and barricaded ourselves behind that door. What about our clothes? They made us take them off so we wouldn't be able to run away. They got them." The others nod just as the cops burst through the door as gun drawn. They are quickly cuffed just as the camera crew and a man from one of the Omaha TV stations swerves into the rest stop, followed quickly by two more. Heavy broadcast quality cameras are hefted in place. Banks of high-intensity lights pop up from the roofs of the TV station's trucks. They blind everyone before them. Coiffed but sleepy newsreaders pop in front of the cameras, microphones in hand. Questions are asked of the senior officer, basking in attention not usually afforded to those working patrol on a rural stretch of prairie interstate. The cameramen film the restrained, underwear-clad would-be killers, one with ominous bloodstains on his briefs, surrounded by posing cops with menacing assault rifles. Finally, the show ends and the pervs are stuffed into the back of two of the patrol cars, which speed away to a waiting jail cell. All this will make lurid eyewitness news TV video, a great feature for the morning farm and food hour. All the next day, at every commercial break, Chirons will tease, "Perverts on the interstate, are your children safe? More breaking news at 5, 6, and 10. The videos make the internet and cable news networks in minutes. Time, 3 a.m. The returning SUVs park behind Fort Shea, as Todd continues to call it. It's nearly 3 in the morning. The guys enter the main floor of the club. They drag together a few tables and pull up chairs. Mary joins them from upstairs. She goes over to the bar and pulls a bottle of scotch and some glasses and puts them on the table. Jay fetches her laptop from behind the bar. Lance says, "I need some food," and goes over and grabs a handful of packs of nuts, chips, and brings them back to the table. Drinks are poured. The packs of nuts and chips are ripped open. Cigarettes are lit. Jay opens her laptop and powers up. It automatically connects to the club's encrypted wireless network. She quickly downloads a series of incoming messages. David looks to her and asks, "Okay, what do we got?" "Our website has the video and stills from the club tonight. First, there's the video of the whole Harry and Steve show from when they jumped onto the stage until the cops zipped the body bags. Then I get still pictures of Harry and Steve on the stage, one of the kid getting shot in the groin, several of the lasers toasting their hands, some of Harry and Steve hitting the floor, the crowd attacking them, and some shots of what was left of them, and finally, the body bag shots. The site's been hit more than 500,000 times and the videos are all over the internet. Want to see?" says Jay. "Yeah, let's see," says David. Jay hits a few keys and a screen rumbles down on the stage, and overhead a video projector switches on. After about 30 seconds, it reaches full brightness, and they all watch the replay and view the stills. Jay displays the network and internet news site pages, all with links back to the club. Then Jay says, "Okay, I'm just now getting stills from the I-80 rest stop. Here they are." The cell phone camera pictures quickly appear on the main screen. David says, "I like that. So will Joe, Pete, and Jack." "Okay," turning to Jay, "make sure there's nothing in the files that could identify us as the source and send those rest stop photos to Joe, Pete, and Jack." "Will do," says Jay. The next morning, the newspapers and TV have full coverage of the events of the night before at Maroon. There are lurid pictures of the videos of Harry and Steve, the shooting, Harry and Steve in body bags. This, coupled with the seemingly unrelated story of the pervs on the interstate, makes for a banner day in Omaha broadcasting. Quickly, the news networks pick up the story, as do local affiliates. Interviews commence on the cable news channels. The entertainment networks are also on the story to spice up an otherwise dull day of congressional show trials. The ratings surge. Pete's day, however, goes downhill quickly. The events took place too late to make the late news, but the morning broadcasts consist of nothing but stories of the events of the night before. He checks his email and finds the anonymously sent pictures and video from the night before. He has a pretty good idea of where they originated. On the TV, he sees even more. He picks up the newspapers that have been dropped outside his hotel room. He knows when Jack sees these, there will be big trouble. Very big trouble. He is seriously screwed up in a line of work that frowns on error and, worse, drawn national attention. Another serious no-no. He prays there's no story giving the real reason for the club attempt. It's bad enough as it is. In St. Louis that morning, Jack, not yet aware of what transpired the night before, switches on TV while he gets his first dose of coffee for the day. Jack lives in a spacious condominium in one of the nicer old gated communities near Forest Park. Jack is about 50. He's been in the crime business all his life, as was his father before him. Jack's dad had connections, and Jack used them. He started out in Vegas running money laundering. Then he got promoted to Dean of Discipline in L.A. He left an impressive body count and few dissatisfied customers. At least none ever complained. He acceded to the Midwest barony when the previous incumbent met with an untimely early demise. Jack was good at arranging that sort of thing. In St. Louis, Jack ruled an inland empire of drugs, prostitution, smuggling, gambling, loan sharking, and just about every other vice known to man and beast. He had the political establishment of six states in his pocket. No one messed with Jack. His fuse was short and his reach was long. But he freezes when he hears the news and watches angrily as the operation in Omaha collapses in shambles. By now, the networks have begun to ask whether there's a connection between the small-time drug dealers discovered on the interstate and the events at the club, although there is no solid evidence of such. Not that the networks need any actual evidence, but because it gives them an excuse to show the lurid footage of four scantily clad guys, one with bloodstains on his underwear. It's a ratings game, after all. Jack now realizes things have taken a very serious turn for the worse. He knows he needs to be very careful and very ruthless. He calls one of his people and tells him to quickly get some untraceable prepaid cell phones so he can make some very unmonitored calls. Jack doesn't want his caller ID on any phones right now. Jack thinks that it's about time that he took direct control over the situation in Omaha, and that it might be time that Pete took early retirement from the business. He knows too much and screws up too much. Not a good track record. Later in the day, Jack receives his prepaid cell phones and begins making some calls. At the same time in Omaha, Pete anxiously calls Joe and emotionally asks, "Have you seen the fucking TV? What the fuck happened last night? I got some anonymous email pictures and video, too. How'd the fuck anyone get my email address? I don't want to talk on the phone about this. Someone may have bugged the line. Meet me at the warehouse in Brigmark and Sid. I'll be there at 1 o'clock. He slams the phone, grabs his coat, and storms out of the room, the door closing loudly behind him. All this is captured by Maroon's hack of Pete's laptop and dutifully recorded by unsleeping software on file servers back at the club. Time, noon. About noon Saturday morning, David and the guys, groggy from the late night before and only limited sleep, stagger into David's apartment for a breakfast of cold pizza, strategy, and videos. They watch the recorded scenes from Pete's hotel room, laughing and high-fiving. "Yo, man, he's screwed," says Mike. "Screwed would be a lucky break. Found bobbing in the Missouri, that's more likely," says Jay. "Totally smoked. Jack's gonna go postal. Punch up the news networks and let's see some PDFs of the newspapers, especially St. Louis," says Todd. They watch the news feeds, laughing and clapping at each new one. They cheer at the lurid, above-the-fold, full-color shots in the Omaha and St. Louis papers. After going through all the broadcasts, David says, "You know, I think it's time we had a little chat with Pete." "What, are you nuts?" says Mike. "No, I just feel he might be open to a little persuasion to renegotiate his contract, so to speak." "How's that?" asks Mike. "Listen, he's on the ropes. Everything he's tried has come up empty. My guess is that Jack is not a very forgiving person. Am I right?" "Oh, yes. Jack doesn't like failure. Neither do Jack's colleagues. My guess is that right now they're not too happy and a little bit concerned concerned as to whether Jack's in control of things, says Mike. Jack knows this too. I guess Pete's got a problem also, and maybe we have some leverage with Pete right now. We've turned other guys in the organization, why not Pete? He's got incentive, and I don't think there's a lot of brotherly loyalty here. He may be able to hand us Jack himself. But once we put together our report, Jack's in plenty of trouble anyway, so why bother, says Jay. Yeah, then after 10 years and 100 lawyers, he walks free. No, that's not the way I see it. I want to nail Jack in the act. Give the cops something they can really pin on him. A real crime, not a paper trail he can buy his way out of, says David. Yeah, well, that's a point. It's worth a try, says David.